Hello and welcome to Theatre Voice at the Theatre Museum. I'm Alex Sears and our guest for this session is the veteran writer Alan Plater, whose Blonde Bombshells of 1943 is currently playing at the Hampstead Theatre. Born in Jarrow in 1935, Plater has a good claim to being the most prolific television dramatist of his time, and in 2005 was awarded BAFTA's prestigious Dennis Potter Award, as well as a CBE. His early successes include scripts for classic 1960s TV series such as Z-Cars and Softly Softly, while his many one-off plays reflected life in the north of England and championed liberal values. His work for theatre has been similarly prolific, including Close the Coal House Door, The Fosdyke Saga, I Thought I Heard a Rustling, and more recently, Peggy for You. All in all, he has some 300 writing credits to his name, and his official CV sums up his experiences rather nicely. It says that he has also written at least 20 abandoned projects of surpassing brilliance and has been fired by some very eminent people and can be very boring about all this in conversation. Ouch. Be that as it may, welcome to Theatre Voice, Alan Plater.
Thank you.
Can we start with the Blonde Bombshells? Mm-hmm. Could you say a few words about how this play came about?
Well, it had its absolute origins in a television film I did in, which I think it was 2000, called The Last of the Blonde Bombshells, with Judi Dench and Ian Holm and Cleo Lane. Two dames and a knight that like to work with the aristocracy given the chance. And that actually took about 18 years to get on screen for a whole set of reasons I won't go into. Had its origins in a little television play, which was never made. And when Peggy Ramsey died, my new agent, Alexandra Khan, said, "This is too good to waste. Well, expand it into a feature film." I expanded it into a feature film, which eventually became The Last of the Blonde Bombshells, about group of women who'd been a dance band, swing band in the Second World War, getting together again in late middle age to play it again. I then wrote a stage version of The Last of the Blonde Bombshells, which turned out to require 25 actors. And the then producer said, "We can't afford that." And in a roundabout way, I then ended up doing a 10-handed version for the West Yorkshire Playhouse in Leeds 2 years ago. So in that version, we had 8 youngsters, and that section was set in 1943 with John Woodvine and Dillis Leigh playing two of the survivors in the present.
And that was the kind of framing device?
That was the framing device. Yeah. Hampstead saw it, not the whole of Hampstead, but Tony Clark, who's the boss man down there, So it said, "I'd love to do it at Hampstead, but we can't afford 10. Can you trim it down to 8? So the obvious thing to do, and I grovelled to John Woodvine and to Dillis Leigh, and they were very forgiving, and as it happens, both working, so we'd have had problems anyhow. So it's just going to be about the young band. So I said, the whole thing, because I need 8 young people on the stage who can all play and sing and be a band, and that's a tough call." So that's how this version came about, and I think I've nearly got it right. I mean, I'd still like to fiddle and fart about with it a bit more yet. There's a stage play is never finished. This is the problem, and the excitement.
Yes, Alan, but I've heard you say more than once that the first draft is the best draft.
The first draft is always the best because that's the one that's written with maximum enthusiasm and passion and a zeal to find out what your characters are about, what they want to do, what they want to say, where they want to lead you. But there are elements thereafter of polishing and refining based on the experience of watching it in the theatre with whichever group of actors it is, and different actors bring different things and will reveal different things. And if you have cast changes, I think that quite often implies little changes in tiny, tiny moments. I mean, there is a moment that one of the changes that I've made in during the run of Bombshells is to change the word crashes to collisions, where Miranda, the posh one, talking about her driving her commanding officer around. Says one in the original, she said, one has had rather a lot of crashes. And I said to her in the bar one, I said, try saying collisions, because it's a more musical word. One has had a lot of collisions. You know, you can do a Dame Edith on it if you like, and it seems to work better. And it's that kind of finicky stuff.
It's also more like the kind of word that the character would use.
Exactly. And having watched Rosie's performance, I thought, yeah, I need two more syllables there. And it's that kind of finicky stuff, which is...
tinkering around the edges. And maybe this would be a good moment if you'd give a bit of a plot summary and tell people what it's about.
Well,
it's set in 1943.
To the extent that it has a plot, because I almost pride myself on being plotless... but yeah, it's based on the actuality of the Ivy Benson Band, which is the most famous all-women dance band of that period. Ivy said that if she played American basses, she would lose an entire section. She would lose her entire trumpet section. So the proposition in my play is that the band, the Blonde Bombshells, are a dance band, swing band, and they've played a tour of American basses, and they've lost four of the eight members. So Act One is an audition. It's chorus line, if you like.
Yeah.
And one by one, these four come in to be auditioned. And the first one is a schoolgirl. The second one is a nun. The third one is a serving member of the ATS. And the fourth one is a fella who's lost his job as a drummer because his dance hall has been bombed. So, and he's also dodging the call-up. So that's Act Two is the show itself when they're going on the road to do a broadcast from what is a thinly disguised Tivoli Theatre in Hull as part of a series called Northern Music Hall, punctuated by an air raid. So the end of Act One is an air raid. So the beginning of Act Two, they're in the air raid shelter, still rehearsing. So we have a couple of numbers and trying on the frocks, and the young man has to try on his frock to see whether he... whether he will pass as a woman.
And some wonderfully ghastly wigs as well.
This is kind of part of it, that the costumes, the wigs, need to be slightly tacky, because that is true to musical stroke variety in the 40s and 50s, which I remember vividly, because my dad used to take me to the music hall. My mum didn't like it very much, really, but I... So I was his excuse for going to the Tivoli to see people like Dave Morris and Jimmy James and all these great comedians. And in among these, there were also the bands. And the first one of the first bands I saw was a band called Big Bill Campbell and his Rocky Mountain Rhythm, who purported to be a cowboy band. Campbell was, I think, a Canadian. And I was spellbound by this. And after a bit, I thought the clothes all seemed just a bit frilly. I didn't expect cowboys to be quite as frilly as this. And he seems ever so brown. And it was heavy makeup, and it was nonsense. It was, but it filled my head with these wonderful visions of I fancy being a cowboy band. And I remember seeing a Hawaiian band. And the most famous Hawaiian band of the period was run by a man called Felix Mendelssohn. Felix Mendelssohn and his Hawaiian Serenaders, who claimed to be a direct descendant of Mendelssohn, who had no children, actually, but nobody queried this at the time. And I think he was actually born in North London. But in another part of my forest, I write lyrics with a jazz composer, saxophonist called Alan Barnes. And the band we work with, I do occasional live shows, I tell the stories, the band plays the tunes, and Liz Fletcher sings the songs. Our trumpet player, Bruce Adams, is a Scot, Glaswegian Scot. He's actually born in Lancashire, but doesn't talk about that bit, but he went to finishing school in Glasgow. But his dad worked the halls, and his dad was at one time was a Hawaiian serenader with Felix Mendelssohn. And his dad's best friend was Joe Keppel of Wilson Keppel and Betty, the great eccentric dancer. I mean, I love all this. The culture of music hall and of variety, I think, has affected the way I work in the theatre. Because when I went to see these shows with my dad, There was an energy, a vitality, the thing that John Osborne fell in love with. I mean, John loved Max Miller and all of that stuff, a vulgarity, but a truth about what was going on in the world that I didn't find in the so-called legitimate theatre that I was taken to as a kid in school, so fifth form onwards.
And what would that have been, Shakespeare?
Well, the first Shakespeare I saw actually did blow my mind. And we were, you know, 15, 16, 17-year-old snobs. Mm. We were the great intellectual set in the city of Hull at the time. So we actually went to see Othello off our own bat on a Saturday night with an actor called Douglas Campbell. It was an Old Vic production. Douglas later went to Canada and worked at the Stratford Memorial Theatre in Ontario. And many, many years later, he came back and I actually worked with him. And that blew my mind. But I'd seen other plays prior to that, the kind of repertory potboilers of the time. I thought, this stuff is so boring.
The kind of Loamshire play that...
Yeah, and I know it's easy now to say, well, no, we got it slightly wrong. We threw out the baby with the bathwater when we condemned, you know, the Rattigan generation, you know, Frederick Lonsdale, Hugh and Margaret Williams, all those people. We condemned them. A lot of that stuff deserved to be condemned. Yeah. Because I sat and I'd watched and the curtains would open and there'd be this drawing room in the home counties. Mm. And they'd come on and talk to each other with very varying degrees of wit and perception. And the big climax at the end of Act One would be when the daughter reveals she was pregnant. Big intake of breath, curtain closes. And you think, oh, God, another half, another couple of acts of this to go yet. And I thought, what has this got to do with the people who are sitting in the audience? And it's a very simple question. What's happening on the stage should have some relationship.
Oh, they had some northern characters, surely. The butler or the maid.
Oh, we were there, sometimes there as comic relief. Anyway, and I'm being very unfair, because there were people like Walter Greenwood who had served as well, and that, you know, the Manchester School, Stanley Houghton, and I think, I mean, there are good plays, and I'm being deliberately unfair. But it's not my job as a writer to be fair, I don't think.
Exactly, yeah. Now, is it true that in a place like Hull, they would have these swing bands doing BBC concerts and so on during the war?
Oh, yeah. There was a regular series, and I mean, I've distorted things to some extent. There was a series called Northern Music Hall, which might only have gone out in the north of England. And they went. It was broadcast from a different music hall every week. It might even been twice a week. So you got a half-hour programme, as I recall, and you'd have the top three acts on the bill. So if you actually went to the Tivoli that night that it was on, you'd actually be sit part of the broadcast. So it was live from the Tivoli. But during the war, it was done anonymously. It would actually say from a theatre somewhere in the north of England. I mean, how this would have affected national security, God only knows, but...
Yeah, can you see the Luftwaffe, actually, sort of
strafing around the north of England, said, yeah. Oh, they're at the Tivoli now, we can't bomb the Tivoli. I think the essential truths of the play are historically accurate.
Hmm. It's also about, obviously, female friendship and everything. What do you think drew you to having an all-woman band rather than...
The little television play that set this whole thing in motion was a series that Jack Rosenthal tried to set up. And it was one of Jack's lovely ideas of an overarching idea that would enable a lot of people to write single plays at a time when television didn't want single plays. And the overarching idea was an article for sale. So in your play, somebody has to buy or sell something second-hand. So I started with a shot of a woman walking down the street, an older woman, looks in a shop window, there's a saxophone, and she buys it. And it then emerges she used to play in a band in the Second World War, which was the happiest time of her life. And she goes busking on the underground and gets spotted by one of her kids, a grown-up Thatcherite daughter. Yeah. And she and her brother are appalled. How dare you do this, Mummy? You know? Yeah, and if you need to, and I don't need the money. I just want to make music. And so that... And that was the beginning of it all, just older. Start with something totally unexpected and then follow your nose and see where it leads. And the unexpected thing of an older woman buying a saxophone from a second-hand shop, that seemed like an interesting juxtaposition. And at that stage it was called Body and Soul, as it happens.
Yeah, I mean, it's also clearly a kind of love letter to swing music.
It's a love letter to the music of the period, because it was such a rich period. And yes, I wrote a piece in The Guardian where I said this, that where is the music of the Iraq War? Where is the music of the Falklands War? I mean, where is the Gulf War songbook? There isn't one. And I think Second World War was probably the last one which had a streak of decency involved and a streak of morality. There was a moral content to that war.
Yeah.
And I think that maybe the music celebrates something of that. But also because being a child during the war in Hull, where we were bombed to hell and back. I mean, in the places, they're being bombed to bugger.
And did you stay in Hull during the war? Yeah. You weren't evacuated?
No. And that's another thing which, to my regret, I never talked to my parents about. At some we could have been evacuated. I mean, kids were being evacuated. Mm-hmm. At some point, they must have sat down. Well, I mean, I was four when it began. My sister was a little bit older. Mm-hmm. And said, "We'll all go together." Mm-hmm. That's a hell of a decision to make, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And my sister is still around. I mean, we've talked about this since. We found it a great adventure. Mm. And we don't remember being frightened.
No.
And I don't know how they did that either.
Well, you kind of trusted your parents, obviously.
Yeah, they made it into a game. And we used to go down to our neighbour's air raid shelter. Not our own, we had one, but we used to share with the next door neighbours so that the grown-ups could play cards. That would make up a forum to play cards, and the kids would be on the top bunk looking down, being told to go to sleep. And we were watching the garden, they'd have flasks, and you know, my mum would bake a cake or something. It was ludicrous. Ludicrous. And that became just the lifestyle for however long the Blitz lasted, which I can't remember now. But also the idea that I talked to so many people in Hull who said it was the best time of our life. Because they were called upon to be heroic. And then after the war, they were told by society, we'd like you to stop being heroic. Would you mind just being ordinary again? And we quite enjoyed being heroic, because we all want to live to our full potential. And that's, I suppose, because I've had the great good fortune to make a living and a career out of writing, and I've lived to my potential, professionally speaking. And I'm aware that we're in a very tiny minority, we who are, find a way to doing this. And I think, you know, the kind of various angsts and malaises that affect the human condition in this country have their origins in that very thing, that if people are frustrated, you know, they're going to go out and get drunk and hit people and or just silk and sit around and sulk and be...
Yeah, just that feeling that the world is unjust.
Yeah, and is that it? is this the lot? And have I been dealt a bad hand of cards?
Blonde Bombshells, of course, it's a really enjoyable, exhilarating evening because the music and so on. But I did feel occasionally it might have been giving too rosy a view of the Second World War. Do you agree with that?
I think it's a legitimate comment. I chose to go that way. I suppose echoing my great hero among drama critics, and I think I've only got one, that's Eric Bentley.
Okay, yeah.
Who said about comedy, he said, comedy doesn't ignore the pain of life. Comedy confronts the pain, but in the end chooses to look the other way. But in the meantime, comedy has taken note and has not forgotten.
So all the characters in Blonde Bombshells have experienced loss, for example?
Yes, they just don't march it around the parade ground. So we hear two specific stories about the one who's lost her husband on the Royal Oak, age 18, one whose husband is a Japanese prisoner of war. I think statistically that would be a fair representation. Any eight women, two would have lost husbands or partners, boyfriends, parents, sons. because I, and that seemed about enough. That seemed, and of course you've got the montage of news, which is there to cover a set change, obviously, but nonetheless, all that news summary that we in Act Two is absolutely accurate to a particular month in 1943. Mm. A chap did point out to me the other night, he said the blitz was, the kind of blitz you are describing, aerial bombers, was over by the end of 41, 42. I mean, it's, by 1943 it was the beginning of the V1s, V, you know. I said, well, please try to be quiet about that.
Yeah, it's called, spread it's it around. Called dramatic license, I think.
It's like, yeah, saying to Shakespeare, because Julius Caesar wasn't really like that. It's a history play.
Yeah. But do you think that the play has a contemporary relevance? Because I was slightly uneasy that the one person who didn't want to be drafted actually was slightly humiliated by the end.
Yeah, yeah. I think it was a different attitude then. I think, I mean, I could have made him a devout pacifist, yeah, but it wouldn't have been as funny. I mean, speaking as a devout pacifist, and again, I don't know what I would have done in that situation, because I've never been, thank heaven, I've never been in that situation. I think cowards are much more better value. And I'm using the word in a very relative sense. I mean, Falstaff is funny because he's a coward.
Yeah, exactly.
But he's also an honourable man. I mean, that's the great, you know, all Shakespeare's characters have paradox piled upon paradox piled upon paradox. I mean, they're complex, and so he's just a young incipient Falstaff from Blackburn in Lancashire, really.
Right.
I'm talking bullshit, stop.
Moving on from Blonde Bombshells, I just wanted to ask you a bit about Peggy for You. Mm. That's a 1999 play about a day in the life of the legendary agent Peggy Ramsey. She was also your agent.
For 30 years, yes.
Yeah, could you talk a bit about her? Yeah, well, how you Peggy, remembered her?
Well, what happened? I think it was possibly my first television play. And acting in it was Henry Livings, playwright and actor, who was later to become a huge friend, an irreplaceable friend indeed. And he said, "Have you got an agent?" I said, "I don't know what you're talking about. I didn't know what they were." Yeah. So he sent me a little note saying, "Now is the time to start." Was it? "Now is the time to stack up a few scripts, send them to Peggy Ramsey, and she will get you your just reward." So I remember it verbatim. The letter probably exists somewhere in my archive, which is in the University of Hull, actually. So I did. And she never actually said... I sent her a couple of radio pieces I'd written. She never actually said, I am now your agent, you are now my client. She just, every so often, the phone ring would be Peggy saying, "Oh, you'll be getting a call from..." And she'd throw some name at me. And it would be somebody at the BBC that I'd never heard of.
Or somebody from an American film company.
Eventually, in fact. "But darling, you'll be hearing from Freddie Zinnemann." You know, that kind of... Without being quite specific what it was about. And they didn't always... It didn't always happen, but...
And that was the day before answer machines, so you had to sit next to your phone.
If the phone rang, you answered it, unless you were out. But broadly speaking, the phone went, you answered it. So, yeah, and we developed... a very, I suppose, quite a close relationship. Not close in the way that Simon Callow wrote about in his book, but I think she trusted me. She trusted my judgment and my integrity. And I mean, to the extent that when she died, and I can say this because it's in the public domain, all the clients said, it was Fisher, all the clients must go into the office and have something, a personal memento. But four of them were specified to go in and have first whack, as it were. And they were, I think, I meant to get this right, David Hare, Chris Hampton, Alan Ayckbourn and me. Mm. And I think my presence in that list might have surprised a few people. Or maybe it's just me being stupidly modest and reticent and so on. So I've got the bench that used to sit outside her study, her room, and there was this bench used to sit outside where it was the waiting area. So some of the most famous bottoms in the world had sat on this thing to the extent that it needed redoing, so we had to have it redone, but I've got it now, and it's stacked high with scripts, just like her famous chaise longue was always stacked high with. And she was, I mean, she wasn't a nice woman necessarily. I mean, Jack Rosenthal had terrible times with her, and has written very vividly about this in the autobiography. But we got on well with her. And I've got a picture on the wall. One of the things I took when I went to the study, to her office, was a lovely portrait that was just got kicking around, so I'm having that on the wall. And I wrote the play to stop her talking to me, because she does, and it didn't totally work. But on things like dramatic structure, which the critics and reviewers and various people who purport to teach this strange craft go on about endlessly, dramatic structure, she said, well, it's perfectly simple, darling. It's always the same. Every play is the same. Lots of little surprises, and every so often the big one. And that's all you need to know. That's all. You don't need any of this stuff about inciting incidents and the reversal of all that McKee speak that is poisoning our television screens. You don't need any of that stuff. You need lots of little surprises, every so often a big one. And the thing I used in the play about taking the audience for a walk across a bridge, which I'm not even sure whether she ever said that to me.
But it sounds like she should have.
It's my interpretation of what she said, and it might be that I made that up as an image, but from what she told me, take us someplace we've never been before, darling. And it's so, these things are actually simple. And we've got campuses full of academics making it complicated, it seems to me.
And wasn't it in Close the Coal House Door, she asked you, what was that about, and how did you reply?
Oh, gosh. I remember she came up to see it in Newcastle.
But beforehand, I thought she said, what's this play about, Alan? And you said, it's about, what was it? Durham miners, or
it was about the history of the Durham miners from before they sank the first shaft to the present day.
Yeah, yeah. And she said, "Make sure it's about everywhere else."
Thank you. I mean, I didn't see where I was supposed to be going. Thank you for helping me out there. Yes, exactly.
Which is very good advice.
And it's this thing about the universality of play. So, I mean, David Mamet, Chicago, we can identify with, because we all have our own Chicago, and most people have their own Southwest Durham coalfield, even though they might not realise it. And it's my job to make it clear that they do have a coalfield. Yeah.
Yes. And was she really as anarchic and wild as you make
out? She was wild. I think it might have been that same trip on where she was going to Newcastle, and I went across from Hull by train and met her on the train. I travelled from York to Newcastle with her, and she was travelling first class in a compartment. Compartments, remember those?
Yeah, yeah.
With these men all reading the Financial Times, and she was cursing and blinding about actually quite well-known people in the theatre and in film, and using every word in the. And these chaps were getting pinker than their newspapers because they never heard a woman with a posh voice, theatrical voice, darling. Fucking and blinding and, I mean, every rich seam of language. And they were very embarrassed.
Yeah, she always spoke as if she was addressing an auditorium.
Absolutely. So, right, yeah. And she didn't give a toss about it. She couldn't care less about these chaps. Hated them.
What about you? Were you cringing in embarrassment?
I was split both ways. I got this boring thing in my soul, I guess, of the ability to see everybody's point of view, which is one of my Shakespearean virtues.
And what do you think made her such a good agent?
She had an extraordinary instinct. She would read, I'm sure she could read 5 pages or maybe 1 page. I mean, it's a thing I put in the play. Darling, if you can write 1 good scene, you can write 2. If you can write 2 good scenes, eventually you'll write a play. If you can write 1 good line, you can write 1 good scene. which lots of people can't even get. I mean, they make perfectly good, they make livings, but they can't even write one good scene. So there are ways of, there are certain kinds of facility that some writers have, but in her view would not have made them playwrights. And I hear a voice sometimes when I'm having conversations with people, let us say in broadcasting, oh, I have nothing to do with them, darling, they're so vulgar, these people. Vulgar was one of her favourite pejoratives. And again, she was right. We're surrounded by vulgar people. We've got them in office now. We're running the damn country, running the world now. The world is run by vulgar people. And she would say, ignore them. And she was old-fashioned. She believed in the transcendence of art. She was a bohemian. And she would have had a tough time in the present climate.
Yeah, she didn't think that much about money and all
no,
those other things.
No, which is why she died so prodigiously rich, because she despised all that stuff. I mean, she actually said this about film writing. Well, if you must go whoring in Hollywood, darling, spread your legs and give good value and get the going rate. I mean, that was a and if any of the guys, as some of us did, go whoring in Hollywood, as she saw it, that was the deal. But don't expect to be happy at the end of it all.
Okay. You've staged most of your recent plays, and some of the early ones, obviously, in northern playhouses.
Yeah.
And was this a kind of deliberate decision to avoid those metropolitan coterie audiences?
No. I mean, I've got a long-standing allegiance to Tyneside, obviously, and it was Newcastle that gave me my... I suppose Coalhurst was the first big hit, if you can call it. It's not a form of phrase that I particularly like, but that was the first time I really hit it with an audience. I mean, when I say a hit, it's when I strike gold in a way that identifies with the audience. And so it follows that over the years I've done a whole sequence of plays up there, to some extent reflecting what's happening. So the last one I did in Newcastle was about an art gallery, and it was called Charlie's Trousers, and it was about an art gallery that has been made out of a bit of an old shipyard, and the two principal male characters, their dads both worked there, and one of them is now working security at the art gallery, the other one has come to steal something. That's the setup, and then we have the artist and the artist's mother, who's been waiting outside. So she's driving the getaway car, and she's a vicar. You know, so it was a classic, if you like, Ben Travers, about a profoundly serious subject where a community is being told one of the solutions to your post-industrial dilemma is modern art. And that's a big idea for your Geordies to get their heads around. They're taking it on. So I did a lovely sequence of the guy who works, there taking the would-be thief, looking at his various items, various artifacts, and my designer made some lovely pieces of art. And so there's one was a graphic thing that composed the letters of the place Hexham, which is a very posh place to the west of Newcastle. The letters arranged into a kind of abstract. So, what's this about? Well, it's the words Hexham. It's to make you think about Hexham in a totally new way. I see. Well, I've never been to Hexham. So if I've never been to Hexham, how can I think about it in a new way if I've never thought about it? And it was taking profoundly serious ideas about art and kicking them around the stage till the stuff... It was Shavian. It's a Geordie Shavian play. Packed the place.
With that one, was it the same experience as you've had something that you dislike intensely when people keep asking you, is it going to transfer to London?
Yeah, quite a bit of that. And in fact, it has been read by one or two London theatres, and I think they're not quite sure what to make of it. Henry Livings, bless him, once described this as one of my methods, is you take profoundly, deeply serious ideas and kick the shit out of them. And I'm not sure that the play of ideas is all that big on the the theatrical agenda down here at the moment, and certainly not in Geordie. You know, I mean, there is no genre. There is the Irish genre. You know, the Irish guys can get away with this because it's somehow expected of Irish people, of Irish characters, that they can talk about ideas, principally religious or spiritual ideas rather than art. And I don't know. And it may well have been. I don't know. I would love to see it done down here, just to see what would happen. And had spectacular performances from my cast. I mean, the four-handers, and they were all terrific.
Looking back at your TV career, which I don't know, I hesitate to say, I think it's 40 years that you've written for TV. Could you say a little bit about your earlier experiences and a bit about what it was like to write drama for TV in the early 60s. For example, I believe you wrote your own screen captions.
I think the second play I did, I moaned to my... Well, for a start, the man I worked for, Vivian Daniels, was a producer and director and script editor, so there's just one guy. So that was a help. And because I'd trained as an architect, I knew a bit about lettering. And I said, I wasn't crazy about the captions in the first play, Vivian. He said, well, could you do better? I said, well, yes, I think I could. He said, I'll make your own captions. So I actually made my own, I mean, the main title of the play and my caption by Alan, actually, with black card and white poster paint. And they just stood them on a kind of music stand, and the camera would point and they would superimpose that picture on the...
Because it was live at that time.
It wasn't quite live, it was shot as live, but actually recorded. And I brought an EP that I quite liked of Mose Allison, a funky jazz piano player. And I said, oh, there's a nice Mose Allison tune that would work quite well. I'll bring it with. So I actually took my own record and they put it on the turntable and they played it in. So we didn't have specially written music. Nothing like that existed. It was a cottage industry and predominantly all made in a studio. And it looks a bit rough around the edges now. But the best of it, the best scenes are very good. I mean, in the one I did the captions for, a play called The Smashing Day from 63, which I think is the earliest thing that survives, with young John Thorpe and young Alfie Lynch. And they are sensational, because they've already figured out how to play to a camera. Some of the older actors in some of the other scenes are out of the Northwest repertory theatres and drafted in, you know, for the little earner in, are doing too much, but these two, and June Barry and Angela Douglas, who are the, you know, the two girls, the birds, they were called birds, you see, also understood how to play to this thing that's 3 feet away. And so it was very simple and basic and cheap and quick. And Z cars in the mid 60s, on Z cars, I would deliver a script and it would be on screen live 6 weeks later. Officially it was supposed to be 10, but John Hopkins, who was then the script editor and the lead writer, said, oh, we don't have to worry with yours, because yours are always all right when they turn up, and we wouldn't touch very much at them. I mean, odd little line maybe for timing or whatever.
And also the output was amazing, wasn't it? How many sort of single plays were
well,
there?
Well, I've calculated there must have been at least certainly two and possibly three a week on each channel, and that comes to 300 plays a year. There certainly would be 200 single plays, half hour, 45 minutes, hour and a half.
So of course not everyone was good, but it did give you that kind of crucial...
People were queuing up for you to write plays for them, and by definition probably 90% were not very good, because no society has ever generated this amount of well-written drama. But it did mean you could really refine your own individual voice. You find out what kind of things you're interested in, what you did well, and I mean, in the great artistic, find yourself, find your own voice, learn to sing your own songs your own way. And I think this is what is wrong with television now, that the kids are with very few exceptions, don't get a chance to learn to sing their own music their own way. They're colouring in the squares on a soap opera and possibly making a very comfortable living. But if they're going to really be grown-up writers, I think they've got to get away. They've got to split like... You know,
and you've also said that programme makers in those days were a bit more daring. And you gave an interesting reason, I thought. You said a lot of these people had actually survived the war, often as combatants.
Yeah.
So they weren't terribly afraid of a memo from head office.
I think this is a very specific person who had flown in bombers, which was probably the most dangerous thing of all as a serviceman, along with the Baltic convoys. The Merchant Navy was, they were all dangerous places, but flying bombing missions over Germany night after night. So if you did that and survived a strong memo from Controller BBC One or the Director General, I mean, it would just get binned. I mean, what are they going to do to me? That would be... nothing could hurt these people. And I think that whole generation had this fearlessness, whether we're talking about Spike Milligan and that his generation of alternative comedians. They weren't called that. They just came in and said, we're going to write, we're changing the face of comedy, which Spike did. And the kind of the Hugh Weldon generation of controllers said, we didn't... The purpose of the war, if it had one, was to liberate everybody, and we're going to have a television culture which will liberate. And it was a noble vision, and to a large extent they pulled it off.
And how are things different now, would you say, over the last 20 years?
It's difficult to get enthusiastic about reality shows, not all of which I refuse categorically to watch. I think the best things that are happening are very good indeed. Things like, I mean, I think Doctor Who, notably, is better than it ever was, better written than it ever was, because I think Russell Davies is a better writer than the ones he's inherited from. And Life on Mars, The Smoking Room, a delightful sitcom, and I love that because nothing happens. I love things where nothing happens, and that's long been my speciality. I think I'm filled with dismay by the soaps and the hospital shows and some of the cop shows. I mean, there will always be room for one. I think Hugh Weldon used to say this: every channel needs one cop show, and the audience expects one cop show. One is probably enough, but I also understand as a market imperative that ITV needs its Inspector Morse or the equivalent. There must be an Inspector Morse, and they're scrabbling around as hard as they can to find the next Inspector Morse. And I might well be writing it at the moment, but that's remains to be seen.
Well, Midsummer Murders.
Not Midsummer Murders, no. Well, they did a one-off called Lewis about Sergeant Lewis, and I'm actually doing one of those.
But do you find that it's become more, in inverted commas, professionalised? So
there are more people telling me what to do. So instead of one man being producer, director, script editor, there is a small committee. When we did Last of the Blonde Bombshells for television, I was having script meetings with the BBC and Working Title and HBO in the States, plus faxes from the States from HBO, so there were, you know, at least six people with six different points of view telling me how I could improve my work. Now, I'm not saying it was beyond improvement, but I do report that I have, I think, 18 versions of that particular screenplay on the computer, and you could have picked any version at random, shot it, and the audience wouldn't have noticed the difference between one or the other.
Yeah, the trouble is when there's more and more people involved to justify their salaries, they have to tell you something else.
Yeah, so. I mean, if a script editor says, this is perfect, you've written the perfect script, the script editor has made himself or herself redundant at that moment, and they're not going to do that. They'd be foolish.
I remember reading somewhere that you'd said that a friend of yours took three actors, I think it was, to see Carol Churchill's Top Girls. And they were totally amazed to see that you could have an exciting play about politics. What do you think that says about the kind of timidity of some of the new plays that have been written recently?
I think there's a piece in today's Guardian about political drama, which I haven't read. I just registered it was there, and Michael Billington's name on it, because it's Michael's got this big thing about public drama and all the rest of it. As a legitimate thing. I think the mistake is to think that a play, for it to be a political drama, it has to be about politicians. And I would almost argue that the opposite is true, that every play, if it has a public dimension, is about politics. I could write a play about a corner shop, or about anything at all, about football, about a struggling jazz musician, and it would be political, because eventually you're hitting a social context which has economic consequences and economic pressures, and that's everything is political ultimately.
Yeah, but you've often said though that plays that are just about personal relationships, you know, when the director says or the producer says to you, I want somebody to either have a fuck or a fight in the first 10 minutes, that can lead to some really soulless drama.
Well, I think where we could be in a reasonably good position is that because the soap operas have taken over what I call gossip column writing, which is birth, death, marriage. It's illustrated gossip columns, dramatised gossip. So they're doing that. So that relieves me of the responsibility. So I've got to find there are more interesting things out there. I mean, I've spent quite a bit of time over the last few years working in Orkney. I mean, it all happens by accident. Now, next year I'm doing my third big community play as part of the St. Magnus Festival. And what you just, I mean, there are lots of wonderful stories I come across. I found a little ad in the Orkadian, which is the local newspaper, two or three years ago, from a piano tuner on mainland Scotland. I'll be coming to Orkney next month. If your piano needs tuning, let me know, and we'll make an appointment. And what I then discovered, this guy used to come across from Scotland and two of the islands, tuning pianos, ending up by giving a recital, an organ recital, in the cathedral. And that's interesting. An itinerant piano tuner. And I did a chat to the sixth form at one of the schools up there. I said, look, there's a story. And apparently the kids then wrote all that. I said, but you're not allowed to write the piano tuner with a girl in every village. That is forbidden. Because that's boring.
Yeah. So avoid the cliches and then.
Absolutely. Walk away from all that stuff. So I think, you know, if it's only about personal relationships, it tends to then become about the writer's personal angst. And my angst is not all that interesting. I'm not interested in it. If I'm not interested enough in my angst to write a play about it, why the hell should an audience be? I mean, they're entitled to at least. I did a series called Trinity Tales, which was an update of the Chaucer about a group of rugby league supporters going to Wembley for the cup final and telling stories along the way. And I did an interview, I think it was for BBC Look North, the opt-out programme. And eventually the guy, he said, oh, tell me in one line what's Trinity Tales about. I said, the central message of Trinity Tales is life is a rude song and you're all invited to join in the chorus.
That seems like a really good place to end it. Thank you very much on behalf of the Theatre Museum and Theatre Voice. Thank you, Alan Plater.
You're welcome.